The next case on the calendar this morning is United States v. Jackson. I see two lawyers in front of me. Would you please raise your hand if you hear me? I see two hands. We have read your briefs. We look forward to your arguments. And I believe it is Ms. Moretti. You go first.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Michelle Moretti for Appellant Giordano Jackson. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I will watch the court's clock. This court should reverse Mr. Jackson's conviction for kidnapping due to insufficient evidence. It should also reverse count one, the first degree murder charge, due to insufficient evidence of premeditation, and then remand the matter for entry of judgment on the lesser included offense of second degree murder. As a preliminary matter, Mr. Jackson never denied that he killed his girlfriend, Alvina Nez, on the night of September 1st, 2017. In fact, on the next day, September 2nd, he told several people that he did so, including a police officer and dispatcher. He killed her while he was heavily intoxicated. In his words, he was blacked out. In a September 3rd interview, strapped to a hospital gurney or bed, Jackson told FBI agent Schultz that he and Miss Nez had been drinking a half a gallon of Vitali on the night that she died. And then in that interview, he also admitted to having hit Miss Nez with his fist in the past, mostly when he had been drinking. And presumably based on that admission during the course of the murder investigation, the government interviewed Miss Nez's aggrieved son, nephew, and father, and discovered that sometime the previous July, 2 months before the murder, Mr. Jackson had assaulted Miss Nez. And that gave rise to the assault resulting in serious bodily injury conviction and the kidnapping charge and conviction. This all occurred...
Before we leave the issue of intoxication, wasn't there evidence to the contrary that he was not intoxicated?
Your Honor, the subject of the second issue, and I'd be happy to address that now.
I'm just asking you, wasn't there evidence to the contrary that he was not intoxicated on the evening of the events in question?
No, there was no evidence to the contrary, because the only evidence that he was not intoxicated on the night in question, there was no evidence, because he was first questioned and observed by officers as much as 24 hours later. And by that time, presumably any alcoholic effects would have worn off. He wouldn't have smelled. And then later that night, after he had cut himself severely and drained blood, he was transferred to a level one trauma center, before of which he was administered sedative medications. And then sometime very late on September 2nd into September 3rd, now that we're getting into about 24 to 36 hours after when he said he killed Miss Nez, the hospital admitted a blood test.
I thought your client himself said that he had not been drinking on that day, and the fight was really over whether or not there was alcohol effect from drinking the previous day. Isn't that right?
He said on September 2nd, and this was at night, 24 hours, he said, "I killed Miss Nez, my girlfriend, last night." He made that statement on the evening of September 2nd, about the night of September 1st. That's as much as 24 hours later.
But did he say he had been drinking on September 1st or no?
He did. He was drinking on September 1st. It was very clear. He said that from the beginning. He had been drinking a half gallon of vodka or Vitali with her. And at some point, he called it blacking out, but there's not necessarily a scientific meaning to blacking out. He could have had memory lapses or any state of confusion. But the argument is that he was sufficiently intoxicated to the level that he was not able to form the cool and deliberate premeditation sufficient for a finding of first degree murder. Now, the intoxication evidence was the centerpiece of the defendant's sole defense to a finding of premeditation. The government chose to rebut that defense, and the government noticed that it would allow, that it would call treating physicians, not as expert witnesses, but as lay or fact witnesses. Those witnesses, the most important being Dr. Levitin, who is the ER physician with 9 years of experience, an attending physician who supervised all of the patients at the hospital, routinely evaluated their whole systems for their treatment, care, and disposition, routinely ordered alcohol and urine screenings for people. And also, she had done a toxicology fellowship at a poison center, at the Bannon Poison Center, before coming into her practice. So she admitted that Mr. Jackson was sedated and confused when he arrived sometime very late on September 2nd or into September 3rd. And at that point, only at that point, that was the first blood alcohol detection test ever done on him. And the government was permitted, witness was permitted to answer that the test yielded a blood alcohol level of minus 10, in that anything minus 10, just or 0.01 rather, or minus 10 milligrams, if there's a conversion, does not show, there's a degree that did not show up on the blood test. For instance, he could have still had residual intoxication, a 0.099%, which would be sufficient. For instance, if an airline pilot showed up to work with that level, that residual alcohol would not be tolerated. There was a point at which that test could not detect any residual alcohol. And 36 hours after being arrested, or after committing the murder, after drinking, it is not inconceivable that he would have tested so low. Yet the government refused, objected, and then eventually the trial court allowed or disallowed Mr. Eisenberg from inquiring about the dissipation level of blood alcohol within the bloodstream.
Counsel?
And
may I ask if Mr. Jackson was blacked out, how did he remember so many details about what happened during the murder, about her falling and about her gurgling and about him sitting by her body for a while? If he were blacked out, how could he recall those details?
Well, Your Honor, he remembered those details at 5 a.m. in the morning on September 3rd. And how many days is that after the murder?
But if he was blacked out, why would he have any memory at all?
I don't believe that would preclude him from having a flashback or suddenly remembering some, or having some inclination of what happened. But
wouldn't, to follow up on Judge Rollinson's question, wouldn't that testimony as to the details somehow undermine an argument on his behalf that he was so drunk that he didn't know what he was doing?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Well, I'm not talking about necessarily. I'm talking about evidence from which the jury could conclude that he was sufficiently compass that he could form the intent.
There was some evidence that they could evaluate the evidence for sure, but
and they did. The jury heard all of this and evaluated the evidence, correct?
But yes, but they were not permitted to evaluate the key factor that alcohol dissipates over time. And that was the centerpiece of the defendant's case, to establish that at the time of the murder, despite what happened after, of the 36 hours later, at the time of the murder, when he struck Ms. Nez, he was out of his mind.
Well, and counsel, why didn't the defense call someone to make that point rather than trying to get it from the emergency room physician. If that was the centerpiece of the case, it would appear that an expert to testify to that would have been called.
Well, Your Honor, first, the defendant has no burden to affirmatively, beyond raising or meeting the burden of production for intoxication, has no burden to take the stand or call witnesses. Second, the government noticed that it would be calling this physician. And it was perfectly reasonable for defense counsel to assume that she would be testifying somewhat as to the blood alcohol test that was alluded to in the notice of
intent. She wasn't qualified. She said she wasn't qualified to make that decision. So if she isn't qualified to make that, give that opinion, then why is it error for the court to say that she can't be questioned about that? How is that error if that's not within her area of expertise?
Well, Your Honor, I've really delved into this in the reply brief. There were several parts to that question. She listed, there was quite a bit of testimony as to her qualifications and her manner of practice in dealing with people with blood alcohol at first. When counsel probed her, she claimed she was indeed qualified. She had studied the rate of alcohol dissipation no more than any other physician trained in emergency medicine would have, and that must be a considerable amount of testimony. There are cases I've cited in my reply brief where that type of testimony is perfectly presentable by non-expert witnesses, by police officers or whomever. However, when she equivocated, she said, yes, there is a general rule, and I'm paraphrasing, but there are exceptions. And it was only to the exceptions to the general rule that Dr. Levitin claimed she wasn't an expert. And then counsel probed that, and then he redirected his inquiry back to the general rule. So generally speaking, though, are you familiar with the proposition that alcohol dissipates at a rate of 0.15 per hour, which, as I've cited in my reply brief, is a pretty much standard rate. Of course, there are always some exceptions within a certain range. That was very reasonable. And it was very reasonable to assume that an emergency room physician with a toxicology background in 9 years of ER experience heading the department would know the general rate of blood alcohol dissipation.
Okay.
Counsel wasn't acting about the exceptions. He was asking about the general rule that would have established the proposition.
Real quick, over here.
Sorry.
No, you started off saying you were going to talk about the kidnapping charge, and that was the lead thing in your brief, and we haven't heard anything about it yet. So I just have a couple quick questions for you on it.
Sure.
You are urging this court to adopt the Third Circuit's case, Virgin Islands versus Barry, and some of the factors, if I recall correctly.
Not precisely, Your Honor. I'm urging this court to define what is considered a substantial seizure for the purpose of a kidnapping statute. As I've explained in the briefs, under the territorial or jurisdictional provision, nothing but a seizure or confinement and holding in Indian county or country is allowed.
Well, let me just jump in real quick because we're running out of time here. Is that
yes.
I understand why in your brief you cite the Barry case from the Third Circuit. That is a very good case for you. Here's my concern, and I know you were not trial counsel. I read through the Rule 29 arguments in this case. I didn't see the Barry case cited to the district court. Was the idea that we should apply these four factors from Barry, based on your review of the record, I understand as appellate counsel, not trial counsel, and maybe if you were trial counsel, maybe you would have actually cited the case, but we are where we are. Did I miss that? Did trial counsel ever actually cite Barry, or at least those four factors, to put the district court on notice that that's kind of the direction he wanted this case to go?
I believe he didn't specifically cite Berry. He didn't specifically cite a four-factor test. But in the course of his Rule 29 motion, he said, I don't believe there was a seizure substantial enough to constitute kidnapping under the rule or under the statute. And he cited the Et City case and distinguished how these facts were very different from the facts in Et City. So we're not suggesting that the court should per se adopt the Berry rule, or there are many different ways that courts have tried to constrain the overbroad reach of kidnapping statutes. Otherwise, to not do so would lend itself to absurd results, where people who have committed a momentary confinement are literally subject to a sentence of life in prison, or they're in jeopardy of it, even if they're not so sentenced.
In your view, the point was raised, although the specific formulation that we might or might not come to was not necessarily advanced, but the point was raised that this was not kidnapping, because if this is kidnapping, pretty much everything is.
Yeah. And that's basically right, Your Honor. And that is the danger and the importance of this court clarifying. And I would note that the kidnapping statute, and this is discussed in the Et City concurrence, whoever unlawfully seizes, combines, etc., and holds. The phrase "and holds" for ransom, reward, or otherwise implies some level, some non-momentary degree of seizure. And in Chatwin and Et City, they've described it as appreciable or substantial, and other courts have done that as well. And even in the courts that my colleague, Mr. Boyd has cited regarding the traditionally broad statutory construction, those cases are distinguishable because they generally do not apply to a case where we only have a territorial seizure without some sort of movement.
We take the point, and it's argued in your brief. Let's hear from the other side, and we will give you a chance to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Voigt?
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is William Voigt. I'm an AUSA from here in Phoenix on behalf of the United States. I heard questions first about the intoxication defense and Dr. Levitan's testimony, and then kidnapping. So with the court's permission, I'll try to address those issues in that order as well. In terms of the government's disagreement with the defendant's intoxication defense, I would note a few things. First of all, the jury was instructed on it. There was a jury instruction on voluntary intoxication. They heard the evidence and they rejected it. There was evidence that the defendant had not been drinking that night. On ER 640, this is part of the interview that Special Agent Schultz had with the defendant. The defendant was specifically asked about the timeline, and this is on lines 10 to 13, and his answer was, it was not last night, but the night before. So the defendant's interviewed the night of September 2nd to 3rd when he's apprehended. Last night would have been the 1st to the 2nd. He said it was the night before that. So the jury absolutely could have looked at that testimony and concluded he was talking about a different night. I would also note that he was interviewed by the flight nurse for medical purposes before he was flown to the trauma center, and he was asked, quote, did you pass out? Were you unconscious at any time? And his response was no. So in addition to many other circumstantial facts in the case, which show the defendant was able to aim 8 machete blows at the back of someone's head, that he was able to remember what happened right before she fell down, the act of her falling down, her gurgling after she's fallen down, all the things he did in that time frame. He remembered thinking while he's listening to her gurgle, why don't I call the police? Because I want to try and wait it out a bit longer. The jury can rationally say, you remember all this stuff right before, right during, and right after, and you've given us some other stories about when the drinking was. We can reject that testimony. Then the jury could have disagreed. The jury could have accepted it. They chose not to, and we think the evidence does support that substantially. On the timeline of it, my friend, presents this 24 to 36 hour period as supposedly being the time between the murder and that toxicology test. I don't think the jury had to accept that timeline at all. The evidence in the record was that Officer Baldwin, who's the first person to talk with the defendant, and this is the person the defendant first says, I've murdered Alvina to, that call was at 7:25 p.m. on September 2nd, and the court can find it described on ERs 450, 472, and 601 as well. And it's also in the Exhibit 119, which was an extraction of the defendant's cell phone.
Does the record reflect how long after the murder that call was made?
It does not. The record does not have an actual time in there as to when the murder occurred. The defendant didn't give a particular time. And so I think the jury could rationally have concluded that it was some period before that, but it certainly didn't have to believe it was 36 hours before that. Again, the defendant talked about the murder having happened the last night and drinking the night before. So the defendant is apprehended around 9:30. That's when Lieutenant Lee arrives on the scene and shortly thereafter sees the defendant. He is arrested. He's flown to the trauma center. He's first encountered by Special Agent Schultz around 1 a.m. So I don't think that the jury has to in any way agree that there was a day that passed or a day and a half that passed. But I also note that the jury could also have concluded he was drinking. But the fact that he's drinking doesn't mean he can't premeditate. And the jury can look at all of the things he did remember, all of the stuff he did, and conclude even if you were drinking, you still had the wherewithal to hit her in the back of the head with a machete 8 times and remember all the things he remembers. So I think there is substantial evidence of premeditation to reject the defendant's intoxication defense. Regarding Dr. Levitan's testimony, I think my friend said the jury was not allowed to consider the key factor that alcohol dissipates over time. And that was not excluded. The district court overruled the government's foundation objection when that was asked. And this is on the top of ER 527. On 526, the question was asked, how long does it take for blood alcohol to dissipate in the body? That objection is overruled, and the answer is on the top of 427. And at line 5, Dr. Levitan says, but yes, alcohol is metabolized at a certain rate, but that depends on multiple different factors in various people. So the objection that was sustained, which is at the bottom of ER 527, that was this supposed specific general metabolism rate of 0.15%. I think Dr. Levitan, the district court, was well within reason. It certainly wasn't plain error, even if the argument was preserved. I think it was well within her discretion to sustain that objection. Dr. Levitan said she couldn't list all the factors. She knew there were factors, but she would have to do research in order to be able to answer them, that there were people who have whole subspecialties to be able to answer that question, and she wasn't an expert. So I think that the sustained objection on that particular point is well within discretion. And also, I think it's hard, given footnote 20 of the reply brief, for the defendant to claim any prejudice, because the reply brief admits that wasn't even the supposed specific rate that the defense was trying to ask about. So there's no reason to think that Dr. Levitan would have agreed anyway, even if that were true. And again, her testimony was that there is no generalized rate. It depends on different factors and different people.
Counsel, if you're going to go to the kidnapping question, I actually would like to start with a hypothetical, if you don't mind, just because I'm trying to understand how the government interprets this statute. So here's the hypothetical. So I have an 18-year-old daughter, and she has a 40-year-old boyfriend. Okay, so we're ready now off to a great start. So the 18-year-old daughter, 40-year-old boyfriend, I get a call from my daughter. She says, I'm at the post office. And I say, why are you there? She says, because we're going to get a passport because my boyfriend and I are moving to Mexico. I live in San Diego, so that's actually quite possible. They can make it to Mexico pretty fast. So I hustle down to the post office, and I see them about to leave the post office. So we're federal jurisdiction, right, U.S. post office. And as they're leaving, the boyfriend says, I'm taking your daughter to Mexico, Judge Owens, and you're never going to see her again. And she's doing this willingly. She's not being kidnapped. She's willingly going along with this. And so I grab the guy by the wrist, the boyfriend, and I say, not so fast. Okay, so freeze right there. Under the government's theory, and I'm restricting his movement, because I grabbed him by the wrist. And I'm on federal jurisdiction. And there's a benefit to me because I don't want my 18-year-old daughter moving with this 40-year-old man to Mexico. Have I committed a kidnapping under the government's theory in this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think you might have seized him. I'm not sure I would even go that far. But certainly under those facts, you haven't committed both of the elements that are described in Etcity and that the jury was instructed with here. There has to be a seizure,
right?
But there does also have to be, as a second element, a holding.
So let's say I hold them. Let's say I grab them and I say, I'm not going to let you go. If you're taking my daughter to Mexico, I'm not going to let you go.
I think it probably will depend on a lot of the attendant facts. Just given those facts and knowing nothing else, whether he's trying to escape or anything along those lines, certainly whether you have any justification, you know, excuse or defense or anything along those lines, I think it really will depend on how long that goes on, whether he is extremely resisting, what he is saying, other things that are going on.
But it sounds like, I think the answer to the question is yes, it would be a kidnapping under the government's theory. I am on federal jurisdiction. I'm restraining someone from doing what they want to do. I'm seizing them. I'm holding them. And I'm gaining a benefit from it. I don't want my daughter to go to Mexico with this guy. Wouldn't that satisfy how the jury was instructed in this case?
The jury was instructed that there had to be an unlawful seizure,
right,
and a holding. And
right.
So I think that it is, as the Etcity case says, the it's going to be, and I think all of the cases recognize, that it's going to be a highly fact-specific determination. So if we're talking about that you've grabbed his arm for, for a few seconds and there's, you know.
Well, I didn't say that. This is my kid. I'm going to hold on tight. I guess what I'm trying to ask here is that it seems to me that under the government's theory, that could be a federal kidnapping charge. And it seems to me that's crazy if that's a federal kidnapping charge. So what am I missing here?
I think it would be hard to just based on the facts you provide, I think it would be hard to defend that as a federal kidnapping charge. But I do think that the facts here are very, very different from that. And I think that they are the kinds of facts.
Let me ask a hypothetical that's a little closer here. Let's have a conventional crime. I'm walking through a federal enclave, so again, it's federal jurisdiction. Somebody comes up to me with a gun and says, "Put up your hands," and then he robs me. Is that a kidnapping? I mean, put up your hands doesn't mean, hey, you're free to walk away. He's hanging on to me. I'm supposed to be there stationary with my hands up so he can take my wallet. Under your theory, is that a kidnapping? If so, why or why not?
I will say that, again, without more facts, it would be hard to defend the mere...
What more facts do you need?
Well, I would want to know how long it went on. I would want to know...
It's a kind of a normal robbery. The whole thing's over in about 3 minutes. But during that 3 minutes, I'm absolutely stationary because he's got his gun on me.
I think it might be a kidnapping under those circumstances, Your Honor. If you are seizing someone's body, you're telling them don't move,
So that means pretty much every ordinary mugging and robbery on a federal enclave is not only the robbery, but it's also a kidnapping. That intuitively does not strike me as right. I mean, what we have here is a robbery, and people ordinarily don't talk about that as a kidnapping in addition.
I don't think it goes that far, Your Honor. I think that the jury does have to be able to find that there is a seizure and that the seizure is a holding and that it continues for some period of time.
So, counsel, was the jury in this case instructed that there was a duration requirement?
No, the jury was instructed that there had to be holding, and I think I would agree with my friend that implicit in holding is the notion that it is different from the seizure itself. That's why they're separate elements. So the jury was not told it had to find any particular period of time. And I don't think that the case law says that a number of minutes is the answer. I think the court, as it did in Etcity, looks at what happened to this person here in terms of seizure and holding. And the facts that happened in this case are that the victim was dragged out of a car. The jury was allowed to conclude from the evidence that she was stripped virtually naked down to her panties, that she was physically dragged around an area for several minutes where Chunks of hair were pulled out of her head. She was left scraped on her face and her arms and her legs. Her body was covered in dirt. She's yelling and screaming. She's trying to get away. That is the same types of facts that we see in Etzidi, which, again, there was, you know, an assault that was going on there as well. You have somebody who's being dragged. You have somebody who is trying to overcome the defendant's physical control.
Now is aspartation part of the federal definition? You're talking about dragging, taking out of the car, and so on, which is aspartation, but is that part of the definition?
Aspartation is not required, but I do think that when you're moving somebody from one place to another against their will, those are facts you can look at to say, yes, this shows that somebody's bodily movement is being controlled, that they are being held against their will. And I think when you look at the category of facts in this particular case, it is it absolutely satisfies the kinds of facts necessary to show that her body was seized and that it was held for some period of time.
Let me ask you a different question, if I may, but again, a hypothetical question. Let's take aspartation out of the equation. Somebody comes up behind me and hits me over the head, immobilizing me because it's such a stunning blow, and then he continues to hit me. That lasts for maybe, 5 minutes. He then leaves me, and after a while, I recover, crawl away, and go to the hospital. Is that a kidnapping? He's immobilized me. Because he hit me, he's made me stay in the same place for quite some time, and he continues to hit me for several minutes. Is that a kidnapping?
I don't know that I would defend that as a kidnapping, Your Honor. Again, I think that maybe a jury could look at those facts and say that you were held,
I'm asking you a legal question. The facts are undisputed. I just gave them to you.
Well, right, but I think the question I think on those facts is whether or not you have been held, and that whether that element.
Let's say while he beats me, he holds me by the wrist so to make sure that I don't get up.
Yeah, I think that, again, depending on all the facts, and there may be facts that make a difference, you know, in different situations. But I think that if somebody is holding on to you, preventing you from trying to escape, and is doing so for a purpose, for instance, for purposes of.
Well, he's not trying to let me to escape. There's no way that I'm escaping, but he kind of wants to get my body arranged in a way so he can hit me better.
I think that if he is, I think that would still qualify as a purpose under the statute. So again, I do think it's going to be very fact specific. I think if you're looking at the, you know, the transient hand on the arm or, you know, something brief like that, I think it would be hard to defend. But there certainly are situations like Etzidi where for purposes of conducting a violent assault, somebody restrains another person's movement by seizing them and holding them.
Trying to put them on a horse and take them away.
Right.
That's true. I see my time has expired. Just to briefly respond, those were absolutely facts in Etzidi. I think here the defendant was said repeatedly to be trying to drag the victim out of the car and into the hogan, into a private place. So again, we have an attempt to move her from one place to another. So I think that the jury, as instructed, as it was argued below, there is sufficient evidence to sustain the kidnapping conviction.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's put 2 minutes on the clock for response.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will try to address the points in reverse order. First, as to the kidnapping, the court asked what jury instructions were given. They're contained at 5 ER 687. First, the defendant kidnapped, seized, or confined, etc. Second, the defendant held Alvina Nez for any benefit. Those two those two qualities seem to have been merged. And I think that was not clarified because I believe the prosecutor argued that there is no specific duration required of any seizure or confinement. It could be a minute, it could be a day, et cetera. She went on quite at length. And during the judge's Rule 29 ruling, she also found that no specific duration was required. And I had highlighted those passages in my opening brief. As to Mr. Voigt's allusion to the timeline, I would note the timeline is of crucial importance here. It was not until 5 a.m. on September 3rd that Mr. Jackson interviewed David Schultz, the FBI agent. That's when he said, we were not drinking last night, September 2nd, but the night before, meaning September 1st. That's perfectly consistent with what the defendant had claimed all along, that on September 2nd, he stated, last night I was drunk and I killed my girlfriend. That's very clear with a close examination of the timeline. And it must have been important to the jury because the jury's only question for the court was to request a copy of this transcript, which they were not allowed to have. I see my time has expired. Does the court have any further questions?
Any further questions from the bench?
No.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank both sides for their very helpful arguments. United States versus Jackson now submitted for decision.